On This Week in Enterprise Tech, election systems still haven't made a move to be more secure, and previous Facebook CSO Alex Stamos has something to say about that. AI is trying to counter fake news stories, and Curtis, Heather, and I talk with Noah Rafalco, CEO of Midori Interactive, about secure messaging, chatbots, and AI. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 311, recorded October 5th, 2018. Midori Interactive will answer your text. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Build or expand your IT career with flexible training and binge-worthy content from IT Pro TV. Visit itpro.tv/enterprise and use the code ENTERPRISE30 to get a free 7-day trial and 30% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. And by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Wasabi's disruptive cloud storage technology is helping enterprises solve one of their fastest growing issues, data storage. See for yourself with free unlimited storage for a month. Go to wasabi.com, click the free trial, and use offer code ENTERPRISE. And by Slack. Slack is a collaboration hub for work that makes sure that the right people in your team are always in the loop and key information is always at their fingertips. Learn more at slack.com. Welcome to Twyatt This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Marex, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I can't guide you through this big world alone. I need some help from some of the top tech enterprise professionals in the industry, starting with Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, I hear you have some good weather down there now, right?
Well, it's typical cool, crisp fall weather in Florida, high around 90, just a few little puffy white clouds up in a blue sky. It's getting to be that time of the year that makes people actually want to live in Florida. So that's nice.
That is very nice. And speaking about nice, we have, of course, Heather Williams, Senior Staff Product Solutions Architect from Ruckus Networks. Now, Heather, I hear you're saving children from man-eating mosquitoes.
Just bringing the zeros and ones to North Carolina.
Fantastic. Now, you've been doing some traveling lately as well.
Yep. I had 90 minutes notice to get myself packed into the airport on Tuesday. So I'm out here in the vicinity of the coast of North Carolina. And I will be headed to from here to San Diego for the next couple of weeks for a couple of conferences.
Fantastic. Well, hopefully we'll
get to
hear.
I promise to take a shower before I do so. Okay, guys.
Sounds good. Well, folks, today we have a really pretty great show for you. We're going to talk about the security of elections. Plus, we're bringing in a great guest, Noah Rafalco from Midori, to talk about real-time communication, AI, and chatbots. But this week has been pretty filled with some pretty good enterprise tech news. So let's go ahead and jump into the blips. Now, we've talked about this in the past, about organizations, especially social networks, and how they're attempting to weave out fake news. And something we've discussed was how machine learning and AI could affect this process as well. Well, some use outside organizations to vet stories, but some just don't want to spend the people dollars to do that and still want results. Now, researchers from MIT's CSAIL or Qatar's Computing Research Institute might have a better solution. Use AI to measure the quality of the source. Now, their machine learning algorithm uses collections of existing articles to gauge the accuracy and bias of a given outlet on the assumption that a fake news content site will stick to their ways. Now, rather than focusing on their claims themselves, it studies the language used to express those claims. Now, how does it do it? Well, the machine learning models actually are trained by using sites that rely on hyperbolic or emotion-driven language, sites that may be biased to the left that use language of fairness and reciprocity, or conservative sites that mention authority and sanctity. Now, how accurate will this be? Well, after training the models using 2,000-plus sites, they were able to detect with 65% effectiveness and determine bias 70% of the time. Now, in order to ensure the correctness, The models must use data from at least 150 sources to be more reliable for the outcome. Now, all this means is that AI might be a supplemental model to human factor checkers in the near future, but it's providing a runway for more advanced technology to assist with this in the future.
Well, we now know that a North Korean cyber group has tried to steal $1.1 billion from banks. Researchers at FireEye shared details about how a North Korean hacking team that they've christened APT-38 has attempted to pilfer $1.1 billion from financial institutions worldwide. APT-38's main objectives are financially motivated on behalf of the North Korean government. Since 2015, the hacking team has stolen hundreds of millions of dollars from at least five banks, including Bangladesh Bank and Banco de Chile, and has hacked into 16 organizations into 11 countries in Latin America and in Europe, as well as the U.S. Now, there's still plenty of overlap among all of the main North Korean hacking groups, but FireEye researchers say APT-38 stands apart with its specialized custom tools and focus on financial organization operations. To transfer the stolen funds, APT-38 uses its so-called DIPAC malware for the fraudulent transactions, which mostly were performed in less conspicuous increments and sent to nations with rather lax money laundering laws. Then they proceed to burn down the house, deleting log histories and launching distractions such as ransomware attacks that don't ever actually unencrypt the data. At one bank, some 10,000 workstations and servers were taken offline by APT-38's destructive cleanup operation just to cover its tracks.
Getting ghosted by the president. FEMA's wireless emergency alert system got its first ever text-based nationwide emergency alert test on Wednesday. The point of this was to identify problems with the system so that cell carriers, the FCC, and FEMA can work out the kinks and improve the warning delivery. In theory, if you were in range of a tower on a national carrier and using a relatively new phone, you should have received the message. According to Wired magazine, many people did not get the message, and there's no one explanation for this. The causes vary by carrier, hardware manufacturer, and also the firmware release. The way it was supposed to work is that all the major carriers received the alert from FEMA's integrated public alert and warning system, and then they were to send it out to their customers using various protocols. FEMA does want to hear from people who had trouble receiving the alert, and FEMA engineers are working with the FCC to produce a report detailing how successful the test was and where the delivery may have failed and why. If you, like me, found yourself waiting by the phone for an alert that never came, I have it on good authority that despite rumors, the alert was not to report that Flint has water and Puerto Rico has power. Go figure.
Now, how many times have we heard about organizations having breaches due to common passwords from either a dictionary or the most used passwords or just using everyday passwords? Now, the top most effective way to breach a router, server, or any other node or endpoint that's exposed to the web is to try and log on using default setups and common passwords. Well, the state of California has had enough of that. They want to start forcing organizations to pay more attention. Now, how are they going to do that, you ask? Well, they're going to ban weak passwords, of course. The state has passed a law that sets higher security standards for net-connected devices made or sold in the region. The Information Privacy Connected Devices Bill demands that electronic manufacturers equip their products with quote-unquote reasonable security features. Starting in 2020, the law goes into effect and allows customers who suffer harm when a company ignores the law to sue them for damages. Now, this means that organizations might offer campaigns to strengthen their security in this space, but it might take some of those first lawsuits to affect the deep pockets before actually making a difference. If nothing else, this provides the end user with a bit more ammo against organizations that pay less attention to the details.
The financial sector breaches, well, they have soared in spite of all their heavy spending. According to BitGlass, banks and other financial firms have disclosed nearly three times as much information in 2018 as they did in 2016. Between January and August this year, financial firms disclosed three times as many breaches as they did in the same period in 2016, 103 in 2018 compared to 37 2 years ago. The top three breaches alone this year comprise more records than the 64,512 records exposed in all of 2016. Once again, hacking and malware were the primary causes, just like they were in 2016, and they accounted for 74% of the data breaches that the financial companies have disclosed so far. Nearly 15% of the breaches resulted from accidental data closures, and according to the lead researcher, companies should consider compliance with regulations like GLBA and PCI DSS as the bare minimum for cybersecurity, while understanding that much more needs to be done to be truly secure.
The spy who loved me, or maybe just loved to hack my Wi-Fi. Yesterday, the U.S. Department of Justice charged hackers working for the Russian military agency GRU with carrying out a vast intrusion campaign against a wide range of organizations. Victims include anti-doping agencies in North and South America and Europe in retaliation for Russia's recent bans from the Olympics, the Westinghouse Electric Company's nuclear power operations, which supplies nuclear fuel to the Ukraine, and Swiss and Dutch firms involved in investigating the Novichok gas attack on a Russian intelligence defector in the UK earlier this year. But forget simple phishing or even worms built from zero-day vulnerabilities. The GRU has grown increasingly brazen. With remote support from Russia, teams of GRU intelligence officers traveled to locations around the world where targets were physically located, parked their cars outside the buildings, and then infiltrated the organization and hotel Wi-Fi networks to steal credentials or plant espionage-oriented malware. So if you spot a rental car full of military-looking men sitting parked outside of your hotel, you may find yourself asking, is that a Wi-Fi pineapple, or are you just happy to see me?
Now, all of us have had issues with repairing consumer devices and products in the past. Now, I'm actually having this problem right now with my coffee machine at home. I can't find the parts. I can't find somebody to service it. They want me to send it back to the manufacturer. Well, you know, this is interesting because organizations, they have revenue streams by ensuring they control the supply chain and the service organizations that manage their products. Now, as you're well aware, Apple is no different here. Now, Apple has reported using a new proprietary software diagnostic tool to repair MacBook Pros and iMac Pros that, if not used on a key part repair, will result in an inoperative system and an incomplete repair. Now, I'm not sure I can say that I'm not surprised, seeing that the organization continues to expand their services and parts organization and also continue to step into the space and manufacturing their own components as well. Now, without this proprietary software, third-party repair services will not be able to fix MacBook Pros and suffer from issues with the display assembly, the logic board, and the keyboard and trackpad, and the Touch ID board. According to the report, the lock will be put in place if you replace the logic board or flash storage. The computer won't be usable again until Apple's Service Toolkit 2 is used by a member of the company's authorized service provider program. Now, it seems there may be multiple reasons for this approach, some of which are related to security. The question will be, how will this affect Apple as 19 states are proposing legislation for consumers and end users around the right to repair rules? Apple seems to be taken to the next level to bank on the fact that these rules are not yet in effect. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But first, we have to thank a pretty great sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech, and that's IT Pro TV. Now, there are a ton of training sites out there today, a ton, but none of them focus on the IT professional. And that's where IT Pro TV comes in and shines. Whether it's those certifications you're trying to get, the CCNA, CCMP, MCSA, and more, MCSE, all those other acronyms, you just wanted to learn about the latest and greatest techniques of technology, including programming, project management, IT Pro TV has what you need. Now, if you haven't already, go out right now, check it out, because they have dedicated themselves on helping you learn and grow in your organization and your career. In fact, a recent study from MIT says that IT occupations have actually grown by 19.5% between 2004 and 2017, and that's more than eight times the growth rate than for other jobs over the past decade. Now, if you're whether you're from the CompTIA, Cisco, to the EC Council and VMware, IT Pro has you covered with everything you need to launch or grow your IT career. Now, CompTIA recently named IT Pro as its official video training partner. Over 4,000 hours of binge-worthy or on-demand training, and they continue to add content daily. Now, courses are conveniently listed by category and certification and job role, and you can actually stream IT Pro TV's courses live on demand worldwide. You can use it in Chromecast, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, PCs, and of course their iOS and Android apps. Now, I can tell you at work, when I have new team members to start in the company, I need to find new ways to bring them up to speed on the latest and greatest. Plus, others I've managed want to stay up to date. They want to stay on top of the latest and greatest. Well, IT Pro TV offers flexible online training for teams of all sizes. Now, keep your team's skills up to date with interactive training they'll actually want to watch. A ton of engaging hosts which present information in a talk show format, and you'll have a full control over your team's training schedule. You can see metrics like logins, viewing times, courses viewed, and tracks completed, and more. Now, expand your knowledge and professional career with IT Pro TV subscription and join more than 100,000 IT Pro TV members today. Visit itpro.tv/enterprise to learn more about IT Pro TV's team solution and request a free team trial. Or sign up for an individual monthly membership with a free 7-day trial at itpro.tv/enterprise. Use code ENTERPRISE30 to receive 30% off your subscription for the lifetime of your active subscription. Standard subscriptions are normally $570 a year, but you only pay $399 when you go to itpro.tv/enterprise and use the Enterprise 30 code. Now, it's flexible training, binge-worthy content, life-changing results. And we thank IT Pro TV for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, let's jump into the bites. Now, you probably all remember that what you felt and heard about the Russian collusion and involvement in elections in the past 5 years. And it could have also, you probably also heard about the different Facebook campaigns and ads driven by Russian state actors. Now, at Disrupt this year, a former Facebook chief security officer, Alex Stamos, pointed out that the industry nor states have not really done anything to improve the security of election systems since the last reports of interference and disruption. In fact, just this past week, we heard about the EU Parliament Committee taking action against Stamos's former employee. Facebook submitted on Thursday to the EU Parliament Civil Liberties and Justice Committee urged Facebook to accept, and I quote, a full and independent audit of its platform investigating data protection and security of personal data. Now, the assembly summoned Facebook's chief executive, Mark Zuckerberg, but no, he actually didn't show up. And the political consulting, they actually wanted to talk about the allegations against the political consulting firm Cambridge Analytica used the data of millions of Facebook users to target voting during a political campaign. The resolution also urges European justice authorities to investigate any alleged misuse of online political space by foreign forces. Now, this is just the beginning of organizations, the government organizations trying to take account for some of this stuff. But again, in the election space, there really hasn't been too much improvement here. Now, a new report from the National Academies of Science and Engineering and Medical says that to protect the integrity and security of U.S. elections, all local and state and federal elections should be conducted using human-readable paper ballots by 2020 in the presidential election. Now, this is interesting. I want to throw this over to you guys because they're basically saying, just do away with all the electronic stuff. It's time to move back to the old-style thing. And don't worry about moving forward in the electric time until we actually figure out the security of this. Curtis, I wanted to throw it over to you because we've chatted about this in the past. The infrastructure is not ready to support it. We don't see any improvement here. You think it's just time to go back to the old way of doing things?
Well, I don't think it's time to go back to the golf pencil and photocopied sheet. What I do think we need are systems that have some sort of paper trail, so that if there's any question about the electronic record keeping, we do have a physical backup to go to for a human recount. Frankly, I think the system that we were using in the last place I lived, the Scantron system, where you ink in the little bubbles on a sheet and then feed it into a reader, was good because the sheet then went into a hopper that was sealed. The machine did a count of the ballots, and the machine would, upload that to the central site at the close of the polling places. But if there were any questions, if there was a recount, for example, the recount was done using the paper backup. Those physical ballots were all placed into sealed duffel bags, which were taken back to the supervisor of elections office and placed in a secure location. You know, I don't think this is a get rid of all the electronics. I think it's recognized that the electronics could be vulnerable. And therefore, we need to have some second channel, some non-hackable channel that we can use from backup.
Yeah, there always needs to be some kind of a fallback mechanism or something to, for us to be able to ensure that what we have is correct. I mean, it's organizations have this today in their networks and their data. Why not do this in the elections as well? Heather, I want to throw this over to you. Do you think it's interesting that the Facebook security officer is kind of running the charge here?
Yeah, so as much as I'm afraid of being called a Luddite, I am leaning a lot more towards the way Curtis is saying it. Yeah, and you don't want to let the hen and the fox in the hen house here. The truth is that I think there are times that we go with an advancement because we can, and not to quote from Jurassic Park, but should we need to think about whether we should. And it's telling that every security researcher that I've seen talk about this at a Black Hat briefing has always begun and ended their presentation with paper ballot paper trails.
Right. Now, Curtis, you're saying, hey, like, let's find a fallback mechanism so we can double check some of these systems to make sure that there hasn't been collusion or integration from some outside party. But does it also mean that, you know, like, for instance, there's different organizations here in different states. They all can do their own thing. Do we need to have some kind of intervention here to say, hey, this is the process you need to follow in order to ensure security? Because obviously they're not taking any steps in the last couple of years to fix the problem. And that means that, you know, it'll continue to be a problem until somebody pushes along. Is there something else that we can do here?
Well, I'm not sure that there is. It's possible there could be something we might do for federal elections on a federal level, but I'm not aware of any legal authority that the federal government has to enforce standards for local and state elections. Since the federal elections every 2 years are simultaneous with the state and local elections, well, that means that we're going to end up with this patchwork that we currently have. What I would be in favor of, to be brutally honest, is something like we've seen in other regulatory regimes, where what we have are functional definitions. You know, the following things have to happen. You have to have a paper trail or some sort of contemporaneous mechanism for making a non-volatile record of the votes that are cast. Now, they can, you know, if they want to do that with paper, if they want to do that with, you know, linotype machines where they cast lead ingots, it doesn't matter. But the function is what is defined by regulation. I think that would be a good way to go. Unfortunately, that would also require a fair amount of agreement on the part of political parties. And just at the moment, there seems to be some difficulty with that. So who knows what we're actually going to get.
Right. Now, Heather, you talked a little bit about some of the organizations and how they have to have a paper trail. They want to have a paper trail. You know, when it comes to security, is there specific processes that organizations follow when it comes to that? I mean, do they say, hey, from a login perspective, we need to audit these types of things? Or from a document perspective, we need to audit these things? Is there a particular kind of workflow that organizations follow when it comes to securing this type of stuff?
Right, and I was going to add to Curtis's non-volatile to an inviolate method of tracking this. I'd like to take a comment that was given to us from the chat room. Emily the Strange pointed out that hackers will find a way, and she said it in reference to something else. But the truth is that if there is a will, and these have become increasingly elections have become increasingly contentious and increasingly important on both sides. I think that this is something that we really need to get serious about and looking at the methodology to and not just find a way to do this, but be brutal about implementing it.
Right. Well, I think we've kind of beaten that one to death. I think there's another bite I want to get to that's a little different in topic, and that one, this is about swatting. Now, we all know about swatting and the fact that these are essentially, you know, call-ins of fake threats to actually activate an aggressive police response. And we've started to see that in the last week, police departments all over the United States is actually rolling out a system targeted directly at this type of thing. It's what they call a swatting resource site. Now, like the Seattle Police Department acknowledges how swatting works, along with the fact that citizens have requested a way to submit their own concerns or worries. And in fact, to knowledge, there's no solution to the problem existed. So the SPD's site tried to manufacture a way to do this. The site claims that swatting victims are typically associated with the tech industry, video game industry, and or online broadcasting community. Now, they have a process to ask the citizens to create a profile on a third-party data management service called Rave Facility. It's actually run by a company called Smart 911. Now, this service is advertised for public locations and businesses, but it supports private residences as well. And the police department offers steps to input data and add swatting concerns tab to your profile. Now, with this information in hand, the police and 911 operators will receive information, particularly about troubling emergency reports. They'll match it to the location that has already been flagged with swatting concern notices and will share that information and the first responders to inform and improve their police response to the incident based off of this information. Okay, so this is an interesting problem because basically we're talking about individuals that are either trying to prank somebody or they're trying to get back at somebody. So they report a unlawful event happening, whether it's a hostage situation or something, and it causes the police to respond to this type of thing. Curtis, I want to throw it over to you first. Do you think just by registering yourself on here and saying, "Hey, I might be potential victim to this. I'm not, there's somebody coming at me," that this is going to be helpful, or could this be exploited as well?
Could it be exploited? Well, almost anything can be exploited, but I think this could be helpful. And frankly, if I were a journalist in the gaming industry or in certain parts of social media, I might well want something like this. I'm fortunate in reporting primarily on a part of the industry that is populated with either folks who are grown-ups or people who consider swatting to be beneath them. Either way, I'm happy about it. But I think that if you are someone who's in an industry type and who has a particular type of visibility, that this kind of resource would be very useful. You know, we've seen a couple of times that swatting is not just an annoyance. Swatting can be deadly. If the SWAT team goes in having been received a report that there is an active shooter, hostage situation, all kinds of stuff, they go in prepared to meet armed resistance. They crash through the door to someone who is absolutely unprepared and has no idea of what's going on. The results can be quite deadly. We've seen this. This is not just a prank. This is something that is horribly serious. So I applaud this particular law enforcement agency for doing what it has done to try and lower the incidence of this very deadly kind of gamesmanship.
Right. So, Heather, I want to throw this to you because I think that what they're trying to do is they're saying, hey, it doesn't matter if you're an enterprise organization, if you're an individual in the limelight, or if you're just an average citizen, if you want to go update your profile to have swatting concerns in there, we'll use that information to actually help us make better decisions around this. But again, it's like Curtis said, like everything can be exploited here. Do you think that this is a good way to kind of make to actually better the situation?
Well, unfortunately, I have to send out a caution not against doing this, but against us saying that if you're in the public view or if you belong to a certain sector, then you may need to consider doing this. It's unfortunately gotten a lot more widespread than maybe some people realize. As you all know, I'm out here in North Carolina, and I'm surrounded by first responders because of the work that I'm doing to help with the hurricane relief. I was speaking with the police department of a small town just up the coast from me yesterday, and they had an incident of swatting. They were actually able to, with federal authorities, help track it down. The offender was a 16-year-old in Canada, and he swatted Joe Schmo for reasons that, as Curtis pointed out, because he was probably not being an adult because he thought it was a prank. As you've pointed out, it's a sad state that this is what it's coming to. But I think that it's something that, as much of a believer in privacy concerns as you know that I am, if it's getting to the point where it has cost lives, and more teenagers seem to be treating this as a dumb jokes feature.
Right. Emily the Strange has an interesting comment in the chat room. She says, you know, if you're going to put yourself on here, you also should be forced to have your information gathered and potentially even a background check and so on happening as well. Now, that's interesting because that means that, again, we're going a little bit deeper into that kind of personal information and security side of things. And that could mean that, you know, if somebody goes and posts your information on this profile as well, it can cause and trigger some other things. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure how this is going to work out, but hopefully it does at least better the situation because, like Curtis said, it can turn deadly at some point. Well, folks, that does it for the Bites. You know, next up is my favorite part of the show. We get to talk to a fantastic guest who brings and drops some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. But first, of course, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Now, you might have been saying, hey, you know, I have cloud storage today, and it's expensive. And the more you store in it, the more expensive it gets. And the more times you perform operations on it, and the more times you access it, the more time it gets more expensive. Well, in this day and age, it's true that most cloud storage companies, that's how it works. Now, the cloud storage competition these days sees how low they can actually get their storage fees and the ingress and egress fees. But from experience, I can tell you that if you go to the bottom cheaper tiers of these services, you also give up performance and reliability as well. Now, these things and more is where Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage prevails. Now, if you're doing just small projects, personal ones, all the way up to large enterprise projects, Wasabi seems to have figured it all out. Now, listen to this cost. 0.49 cents per gigabyte per month, which is about $4.99 per terabyte per month. Plus, listen to this. This is a game changer because this is how they do their costing. Unlimited free egress for your data. That means that no charge for API calls, so you don't have to pay for it to actually access your data. Now, you should go check it out, that what you're already paying for your cloud storage right now, because I can tell you right now that not having or including egress fees and API calls for those CRUD operations will substantially save you money on cost of doing business. Now, you're probably thinking, well, if they're cheaper, they must be slower, or they don't have all the features and bells and whistles that the other companies have, right? Well, Wasabi has really developed some pretty disruptive technology here. They have ways to actually pull raw performance out of their storage devices without compromising on the other stuff. Then they have a revolutionary process that lays down data on disks sequentially as opposed to blocks. And now what happens? Well, that means Wasabi's cloud storage is 80% cheaper and 6 times faster than the competition and the industry leaders out there. Now, if your organization is worried about compliance, Wasabi has you covered as well with HIPAA, FINRA, and CJS as well. And they figured out that fast, cheap storage doesn't have to actually go against security as well. Wasabi has an answer. Wasabi offers a unique feature called immutable buckets that cannot be deleted or altered, thus protecting your valuable data from accidental or malicious destruction, which is not available from some of the competing solutions as well. Now, 11 nines of durability. Now, if you're worried about migration to cloud services as well, Wasabi also has an answer for you. They have their Wasabi Ball Transfer Appliance. Now, this thing is powered by Netgear, and it's designed to transfer large data sets while actually dramatically reducing the costs of migration. Now, I bet you probably want to go try it out. Well, if you do, experience Wasabi for yourself with free unlimited storage for a month. Go to wasabi.com. Click the free trial link and enter the code ENTERPRISE. See how much storage in the cloud can save your business. That's wasabi.com and enter the code ENTERPRISE. And we thank Wasabi for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it brings us to the really great part of the show. We get to bring a guest in and drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And today we have Noah Rafalco, CEO of Midori Interactive. Welcome to the show, Noah.
Thank you so much.
Now, Noah, we know that from the traditional IT industry, there's been quite a disruption when it comes to when actually we're including AI or different facets of AI. But Midori also has some in-depth knowledge of telecom as well and messaging. Can you maybe bring us through some of the solutions there and how you're going to change in the market?
Sure. Thank you so much. So really, I come from advanced communications technology deployment for many decades at this point. I get to live on the edge where people normally don't get to live. So what you eventually incorporate into your lives, I'm in probably about 5 to 7 years ahead of most consumers. So in telecommunications, there are advancements all the time. It's an ever-moving industry. So in this case, it would be text messaging enablement on regular local landlines, like your consumer landlines, your Comcast, Time Warner, home phone numbers, as well as your business lines and toll-free numbers. So that's where this conversation would start.
Yeah, so this is actually now, what kind of approach is Midori taking from this perspective when it comes to, you know, kind of securing this type of medium?
Well, it's really interesting because I'm listening to all the security issues that you've discussed, and I've watched other podcasts as well regarding this. And I live in a different space, being telecom. And when you think about voice telecommunications, you think of regulation, you think of protection, and then this new technology of text enablement came along, and it leaves most businesses and consumers quite exposed where they don't understand what that technology really means and what they can send across it without worry.
Right. So there is a product that you guys offer, which is called, it's called Text Protect. Now, can you maybe describe what this service is and how it actually helps organizations?
Absolutely. It's a great question. Well, as I entered texting communications, I realized that I came from a very highly regulated industry, being voice communications, and I stepped into what I affectionately call the space of messaging as the island of Dr. Moreau, where I didn't understand what was going on when I landed there. I just saw these beasties that I didn't recognize. And what that really means is that when you text enable a number, you really are taking a different communication channel than what you traditionally used to use that service for. Just like we did with cellular phones. When we first had cellular phones, there was no texting at all. It eventually morphed into on-network texting and then could do inter-carrier texting so that you can communicate with other people on other people's networks. Text Protect was the concept that we came up with, and I recently filed a patent to support this, to protect all consumers and businesses from their services in texting being hacked or hijacked without their consent. So Text Protect actually allows a end consumer or enterprise to put a 8-digit alphanumeric PIN on their phone number to protect from nefarious behavior. So for example, a large credit card company, maybe less than a year ago, their main toll-free number was hijacked for 2 weeks. Nobody knows about this because the credit card company would never expose that to the public, knowing that people could be texting in highly critical, highly sensitive private data. So this is where Text Protect came in. Text Protect also covers the ability to efficiently migrate numbers from one provider to another. So if you think of voice today, you actually migrate from one to another and you have to sign paperwork. So Text Protect completely automates and digitizes that process.
Interesting. So how is it from a messaging perspective, how is it actually securing here? Now you actually have to, if you want to enable a new SIM card or something, you actually have to use a PIN. Like how is it actually protecting messaging?
Well, it's interesting. In the cellular networks, which is very different than landline networks, in the cellular networks, as you know, people can get hacked. So a friend of mine that recently flew back from Tel Aviv, he founded this tiny little company called Vonage, that big phone company. And he landed in JFK and his cell phone was actually hacked, meaning that they took the information and put it on a new SIM. In the new texting environment, you don't even know that happens because your voice still works on your telephone numbers, but your texting may end up somewhere else.
Interesting. So now, how are you getting in between that? Are you working with the telecom companies to offer this new process, or is it a new technology that you're embedding within the phone, or how are you kind of engaging and becoming kind of like that middleware that protects this more?
That is a great question. It's taken years to create this, and lucky enough, I'm in the industry high enough that I work with the registries that maintain the data ownership of every person's landline's number and who receives that message or who has the authority to receive that message. So I first went to the two registries that control all of that data storage. One of them's called NetNumber, who controls all the local number enablement and texting enablement. And another is SOMOS, the toll-free administrators that control all the toll-free numbers. I went to them with this problem saying that there is some nefarious behavior happening, that companies are getting hacked, and I have an idea to solve this problem. So the only way to solve a problem at an industry level is to actually approach it at those choke point levels. So I approached those two registries and are now completing the technical integration to not only allow enterprise, small business, and consumers to protect their numbers from that activity, but also even before they text enable it, it being free to the consumer and to the enterprise.
So Midori Interactive kind of offers a bridge from multiple different messaging platforms too here, right? They offer the ability of channels with SMS and MMS, but also social networking mediums as well. So it's more of a platform, right? Can you maybe describe how that kind of how you've kind of built out this platform?
Absolutely. Another great question. So when you think about omnichannel and how we communicate today, if you just rewind maybe 15, 20 years ago, we only had this thing called a phone. And we communicated with each other through this thing called a phone line. Ever since then, your phone number is actually taking on multiple lives. So in WhatsApp, it's your identity, and your cell phone, it's an identity to applications. It identifies you. So what we've done with Midori is basically create a communications bridge. And in that project, what we identified is that if you don't own the service application layer like texting on your number, then it causes a problem. So we started with Text Protect, but we also allow people to have an engagement solution that, unlike a lot of companies that require coding, I don't code, so I can just tell coders what to do. So what I suggested and demanded from the people I hired was the ability for a normal person like myself to be able to create an interactive communications conversation, just like a voicemail system in a sense, or something that was the beginnings of a website back in the day, where you could offer up information and attach all the different communication channels, whether it's Facebook Messenger, whether it's Skype, whether it's Telegram, SMS, MMS, so that you can manage that as an enterprise very easily and deploy it within minutes.
Wow, so this is almost like a portal or some kind of service that you kind of log into and you start providing the different mediums that you actually communicate on, and then it starts to actually collaborate and make use out of all that? Like, how does the system kind of work to kind of connect everything together?
Another great question. So just imagine that your communications is a big funnel and that you use SMS, some people use WhatsApp, some people use all these different communication channels, and they're very siloed. So you don't have a consistent form of communication. And if you try and apply that to a business model, it becomes very laborsome to try and manage all these channels. So all we did is create a very complex environment behind the scenes to offer a very simple solution in the front that you could push all those communication messaging channels, anything you communicate with your thumbs, into the top end of the funnel and have it interact with a templated, customizable interactive bot so that you could manage that and deal with one interface as opposed to several.
Interesting. Now, there's a lot of organizations out there. They have a ton of communication, obviously a lot of marketing solutions, a lot of service organizations. They use messaging for their clients and their services. You know, how does this system scale? Because I know that you know, you have your organization is going to have tons of ways of communicating, whether it's over messaging or social network. Can it scale out? You know, what kind of system does it support the back end here that can ensure that the organizations and enterprises are supported?
Well, lucky enough, I came from telecom, so I know how to build things at scale. And when you build things at scale, you have to simplify them drastically so that you do not complicate the end user experience. So in telecommunications, when you build things at scale, that means you have to be able to support, at some points, hundreds of millions of access points at once and still stay up. And a great example of that is what you see with websites. When someone wants to hurt your company, they do what's called a denial of service attack. In other words, they're hitting your web server with so many attempts that it overloads that server. We built our solution in the cloud that is diversified globally over AWS, so there are no issues like that.
Interesting. So maybe you can give us a quick high-level overview of the architecture. So you're saying that you work, a lot of the services are built on for scale on AWS. What about some other areas like, you know, security and securing transport and data management and so on? And then maybe around disaster recovery, like what kind of areas are you kind of handling from the service and platform perspective?
Another set of great questions, and that could be broken up into a few things. So I'll give you one example about disaster recovery, which DR is a very important aspect to communications because you as a consumer expect that you're going to pick up your communication channel and always get through to your vendor. When recently, about 9 months, maybe a little over a year ago, this huge phone company had an outage on their voice end of their network. If they had texting incorporated, they could have responded to those customers through a completely different ecosystem than the voice channel that went down and still keep that DR up and active. So that's where it really comes into understanding the DR aspect. And you know, when you think of adding any communication channel, you're looking to augment an existing channel as opposed to completely replace it. And that inevitably gives you that DR solution.
Fantastic. Well, we do want to talk a little bit about more about this because we know that you also have some other solutions around chatbots and using AI as well. But we also want to thank another sponsor of This Week Enterprise Tech. And of course, offer after our sponsor, we also want to bring back in our co-host panelists as well to ask some questions and have some discussions. But of course, like we want to do, we want to go ahead and thank our next sponsor, with that's, of course, Slack. And, you know, first, I want to tell you that Slack is definitely an amazing collaboration engine. I've used it in the past for many different ways, whether it's dealing with customers or interacting with groups on the internet, or even services and sales. I can tell you Slack is definitely a collaboration engine. Now, many IT organizations, operation teams, they actually use Slack to communicate about developments that happen in the wild. They bring together and they create different channels. They let organizations and have conversations in real-time messaging as well as with video and voice. They can share things, file share. They have a really great set of features. Now, why use email when you can actually save time and go back and search and gain historical context from different discussions from all different groups and teams and topics? I mean, that's one of the greatest features of Slack is you can kind of go back and look at the historical context, whether you're having a training session or you're having a chat session with your sales group, you're talking about a customer. You want to be able to go back if you're not part of that conversation and review all that historical context. Well, Slack also brings a really great, rich environment for keeping people up to date. You can create new channels for new issues. You can show alerts for real-time updates and channels. Plus, Slack can integrate with all of your favorite systems to kind of bring that information to you all in one place. You get the data from Jira or Salesforce, Zendesk, Google Drive, or even hook up a webhook from any of your favorite services. And it basically makes Slack that collaboration hub. Now, Slack keeps teams together, ensures that they're communicating efficiently and staying productive every step of the way. Now, you imagine a sales team getting together on Slack. They can chat about new and inclusion products that are part of their services. You can educate them, and then people can come back, even if they're not part of that conversation, and look back at that discussion later on and gain that insights. Slack creates a place where everyone can stay up to date and ensure that they don't miss anything. Now, having used Slack, I can tell you there are some pretty great features they have. I love Slack threads. You can have little conversations off to the side. You can start another thread about something else that's happening during the main conversation. Plus, you can search is actually super simple because you can go back, you can search in channels, you can use search modifiers like from a specific person or about a specific topic. It helps you narrow down and find what you need. Now, people of any generation have found ways to use Slack to increase their productivity, whether it's planning a reunion or handling different facets of an event or supporting a product. I'll tell you, Slack will make it easier. There are tons of public communities and organizations using Slack. I've actually joined dev chat and designers and UX spaces to just chat about industry standards and topics, to discuss the trends and why things are improving. Now, Slack actually also has a really strong app ecosystem as well. They have some, like I said, really great integrations with Jira and Salesforce, Zendesk and more, but they have over 1,000 apps. You want to integrate with your own system? Well, Slack has a super thriving developer community as well. You just hook up webhooks. Bam, you get the information in Slack. It also works anywhere. They have iOS, Android, Windows, and Mac apps that actually sync seamlessly where you can actually pick up where you left off. Now, there's over 200,000 developers that use Slack to build what they need to increase their productivity and collaboration. Now, think about why Slack is an amazing sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, because Slack brings the collaboration back to your enterprise as well. They actually have Enterprise Grid, which lights up your workplace, and it can link together shared channels, take advantage of an entire graph of communication for your organization. Now, Slack reduces your emails, streamlines your communication, saves time, and increases your productivity. I can't say enough great things about Slack. With Slack, your team is better connected. Learn more at slack.com. That's slack.com. And we thank Slack for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we're talking with Noah Rafalco, from CEO of Midori Interactive. Noah, thanks so much for being here on the show. We talked a little bit about your communication products, secure texting and so on, secure messaging. We do want to get a little bit into the other side of things as well. You also have several chatbot services, correct, that kind of integrate with your business. Can you maybe describe some of the stuff that Midori is doing in that space?
Absolutely. And since you mentioned Slack, I just want to let you know that that was one of the first integration points that we connected to so that we could actually put a bot within the Slack channel. And that is important because you have to imagine that. Imagine having a virtual assistant within the conversation to assist you with data that you didn't want to go look up. So that's where a bot can come in. So when we talk about interactive communications bots, they can actually lay over anything. So you'll see that when you go to a web chat window, sometimes it says, "Hi, my name is Jane," or whatever. You actually are probably talking to an automated bot at that point. So just imagine a bot as a low-end assistant that can solve simple issues for do-it-yourself transactions, whether it's looking up information that you don't want to go search for, or solving an issue as simple as, I just want to know the hours and location of the business I'm trying to communicate with. So it's that simple. And it really runs into start with simple and then modify or evolve into, once you have the data, into more of an AI experience where you can take that data and really have actionable results from that data.
Now, what kind of organizations does this help? Does it help services? Is that financial? Like, are you targeting a specific set of businesses for these chatbots, or is it, just all in? Any organization, any type of organization can only utilize this.
It's great question. So, when you think about hours and location, your invoice, frequently asked questions. If you look at it from that perspective, chatbots actually apply to all business. And coming from telecommunications, clearly I already deal in that industry. Every business already operates with communications. So, of course, it would be natural for us to get into something that was as ubiquitous as telecommunications itself. And chatbots do apply to every business, whether it's hours in operations, invoices, frequently asked questions, surveys. Anything that you do today could be, at least in the simple state, automated through a chatbot experience and lower labor cost.
Right. Well, I do want to bring my co-host back in. Now, Curtis, I want to throw it over to you first because you had some questions about how organizations are interacting or integrating this in.
Yeah, I am curious because you know you've done a great job of telling us what this is, but I'm curious what it feels like to use it. If I'm a user or an employee in an organization that's using this, do I notice a difference in my conversation to conversation interaction with my phone, with my technology?
You know, Curtis, that's a fantastic question because we get challenged with this with large enterprise that want to solve, you know, like the peace in the Middle East right out of the gate. And you really don't do that. Now, let's bring it back to something that a lot of folks have, whether it's Google Home or Alexa, which I have several of those devices. I'm a techie. And you can't just sit there and ask for solving a complex math problem. So you start with the simple. So you really, if you need a rules-based, and rules-based is basically if-then go-to kind of statements, I want the weather, I want the news, I want this. They don't take a lot of intelligence to figure out. And that's where you expect that automation to start. When it becomes more enhanced, it's really interesting that the human nature is to challenge that system of AI to break it. So, you know, solve the simple first. And with the simple, you only expect the simple. As you add AI, then you expand that and keep that data set where it can be more reliable. So, for example, one of the things that I've learned in AI is that there are two types of AI. There is precise based AI and more wide based or broad AI. And intentionally narrow based or precision based AI are things like we ask for the weather, or we ask her, you know, something. Listen to me, I'm already calling her, even though it's a machine and you know it's a machine. So to your point, you know it's a machine, but you're still asking simple questions. When you start to involve yourself in the situation where you ask it complex things, as a human, you want to break it for some reason. And that's what we just have discovered. So that's why you start with the simple, you solve those issues, you find out what the trend of your customers are or the needs are, and you try and solve the simple as much as you can, and then evolve, just like a website did back in the 80s and 90s, into something more complex like e-commerce, for example, as a comparative.
Okay, so I want to dig into something that you were talking about with training, and I've talked to a lot of people who are involved in building AI systems, and training always comes up. So with your system, is the training something that requires a particular level of AI expertise? In other words, will most organizations need to either contract with your company or with a consultancy to do that training? Or do you have a system that will allow the IT experts at most of your customer companies to lead the training? Or is this one where the AI is so advanced that it trains itself when you put it into an environment?
Another great set of questions. Really, just imagine AI, and a lot of people call AI artificial intelligence. I actually started to call it years ago assistant intelligence because it's not as fully baked as you think. And I actually am friends with one of the first people that sat on the Stanford team, the summer program team that invented AI in the 60s. And they said in the 60s that within 10 years, it's going to be as smart as a human. Well, that didn't happen. So really what happens is that you have to have the data to feed the brain of an AI. So just imagine an AI system as a young child. You don't give them complex math to start. You start asking basic questions and you feed that information into the system. And it's really particular of what problems you're trying to solve as well. So you can't jump from a kindergarten student and teach them college degree stuff, right? You have to bring them along in their journey. And that's where AI is really valuable. Will it be immediate to deploy today? Well, there are some pieces like natural language processing, where you can ask a question in several different ways and it picks up the content and can determine what your question is. But you certainly don't want to say, I want a pair of red shoes with yellow laces from Guatemala. You know, you just can't get that deep without that training. So you do take your information and you train it, whether it's a starting point like with us, where you capture that data and feed it into an AI, or you can have your conversations that may be recorded, whether text or voice, and you can also feed that into the AI. So there are two different paths there, Curtis. I hope that answers your question.
It does answer my question. I appreciate that. I know that Lewis and Mo have more questions. So, Lewis, I'm going to toss it back to you.
Thanks, Curtis. So I think Mo actually had a question about kind of how far does this kind of text-per-text service reach, right, Mo?
Right. And let me say at the outset, as someone who got stung by a scorpion at Black Hat, I'm a huge fan of text-per-text just from what I've heard so far. And I am the first one to complain when I get a phone call that could have and should have been a text message. So my question was really about, so a lot of the emerging markets and regions of the world, they actually have telecoms that are using SMS technology to facilitate money transfers where banking systems don't really exist. And so I was wondering, is this an area that you guys have looked at? Especially, I'm thinking actually, of Safari Telecom, especially.
Well, I would say that that's a different conversation for a different day. One of the patents I had written was blockchain communications patent, and that actually can authorize transactions from point A all the way through the food chain so that you can transparently see certain pieces of the transaction and validate them. So when you talk about text-per-text, I did write that patent in blockchain technology because you need to validate information outside of an operator, like a telephone operator. So text-per-text is basically a number ownership and application to the number. So SMS is an application, MMS is an application, voice is an application. So when you think of those as just applications that reside on what I call your virtual social security number, being your phone number, that's where it comes into play that you need to ensure that you are the owner, that you have the rights to be the owner, and what transacts over that application you own as well as an asset. Does that help, Mo?
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
No worries.
Well, we're running close, a little low on time. I wanted to give you a chance. Like, if an organization want to actually get started on some of these services, where do they go? How do they get started? How do they get signed up? What do they have to do to kind of get started and start using things like text-per-text and some of the chatbot services?
Well, we are just in the final throes of text-per-text right now, working with the registries for the database APIs to function as expected. We're a little bit more advanced than even the folks we deal with in telecom. Big shock. So what I would say is come to Midori.ai, sign up for getting informed of the news, and we will get in touch with you because there's so much more than even text-per-text that you can take advantage of. It really comes into understanding that a new channel of communications has evolved. Even though we use texting every single day between each other, consumers to business is just starting to evolve today. So to set that up right and to engage, please reach out to myself, which you could see my email address there. You can also come to Midori.ai, and we'd be happy to have discussions with you and set up demo accounts to help you along in your journey of messaging enablement.
Fantastic. Again, that was Noah Rafalco, CEO of Midori. Thank you so much for being here. But unfortunately, folks, we've run out of time. You've done it again. You sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe, according to 9 out of 10 bots. But of course, I want to thank everyone that makes this show possible, especially our co-host in crime, with whom I could not do the show without them. Starting with Heather Williams, Senior Staff Product Solutions Architect. Thank you for being on the show. Thank you for being here. Thank you for trying out your wireless foes, your actual wireless issues there and getting through all that. Appreciate that. And thanks for being here.
Well, thanks so much. It was a great fun again. And a shout out to ITDRC and all the great work that my group of there's a whole bunch of volunteers out here up and down the coast of North and South Carolina helping folks recover from Florence. And these guys do great work.
Fantastic. Now, Mo, where can they go to find some of the work that you're doing and maybe follow some of the stuff you're doing that you're up to?
Mostly I'm at MoBetter Wi-Fi on Twitter. Occasionally I'll write a blog for Ruckus when they let me. And so I'll have some comments there, obviously, about what we're doing out here.
Fantastic. That's Heather Williams from Ruckus Networks. Thanks so much, Heather. And of course, Kurt, we can't do this show without Curtis Franklin. Curtis, you are our enterprise tech specialist that we love reading about your articles and all the things and all the little travels that you're doing and all the trade shows you're going to. Can you maybe tell the folks at home where they can find your work and all the things that you're up to?
Well, they can always find me at Dark Reading. As a matter of fact, on Monday, I've got a big article coming out. I've got a series of pieces that I'm doing regarding artificial intelligence or machine learning in security. And the first of those hits on Monday. So I would love the Twilight Riot to go over on Monday, take a read, and let me know what you think. Because as I said, I've got more coming. I will point to pretty much everything I write on my Twitter feed at KG4GWA. And as far as being out and about in the world, this next week I'm here in the office. But the week after that, I've got a couple of conferences I'm going to be hitting. One is the Internet 2 Tech Conference, which is here in Orlando over at the Universal Studios area. And then Gartner, the Gartner IT Symposium is down at Disney. That's a huge conference filled with CIOs and Gartner consultants. So I'll be reporting from there. Exciting times coming up. Please let me know what you think and what you want me to cover. Hit me up on Twitter. I look forward to hearing from you.
Fantastic. Looking forward to it, Curtis. Curtis, Heather, thank you so much for being here. I look forward to guys seeing you guys again soon. Also, I want to thank you. You are our loyal listeners, our followers. You come in each and every week to get your enterprise goodness, and we want to make it easier for you to watch and listen for the show. We want you to go out right now to our show page, twit.tv/Twilight. There you'll find all of our amazing back episodes, plus all the show notes, information about our guests, links to the show, links that we did during the show, of course. Importantly, next to the videos there, you'll actually see those really helpful download and subscribe links. They help you support our show by getting an audio version or a video version or an HD video version and listen to any one of your devices, whether it's a mobile device or your desktop device. It's the best way to pretty much stay on top of your enterprise and IT news. Now, after you subscribe, we want you to share the show with your friends and family and coworkers. We love doing the show, and with your support, we can keep doing it. Now, after you subscribe, also remember, we do the show each and every week live at 1:30 p.m. Pacific at live.twit.tv. And if you're going to actually watch the show live, you might as well jump in to the chat room live as well at irc.twit.tv. We love the chat room. We get some great questions from there, whether it's Kalu or Ripple Rider or any Emily the Strange. We always have some great stuff to chat about and to ask questions to our guests. So feel free to jump in there and be part of it as well. Also, don't forget to follow me at twitter.com/Lou. You get to see all my work that I do during my daily week at my job at Microsoft, where we actually check out dev.office.com. We can see all the latest posts and great things about customizing Office. In fact, you can see some of the sessions we did at Ignite in the previous weeks. Also, I want to thank everyone who makes the show possible. Thanks to Leo and Lisa to continue to support us each and every week to do this week in Enterprise Tech. Also, thank you to our tireless producer, Mr. Brian Chi. He's on vacation right now on the East Coast, but he's still in the chat room. He's still in our back channel here, helping us out, leading our way. So thanks, Chibert, for being here, and thanks for supporting us. Of course, before we sign out, we have to thank our TD for today, Kevin. Kevin, of course, tradition. We have to follow tradition. What was the major topic of today's show?
Jarvis and Hal and other beings that'll take over our world soon.
Very, very close. So close. But unfortunately, the answer we were looking for was chatbots. But you were pretty close. I think that was pretty close.
I think Kevin's new name is Dave.
I think so too. Well, thanks, Dave. We appreciate you being here. Thanks so much for your support. And until next time, I'm Lewis Brusk saying, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep TWiT.